Let's turn to Genesis chapter 28. Genesis 28. I'm going to be looking at Jacob's vision this hour. By way of introduction to that, first say that Jacob is one of the most important characters in the Old Testament, and the story of his life goes from Genesis chapter 28 through 36. So as you can see, he's one of the main characters of the Old Testament. And Jacob is the father of the children on whom the entire Word of God centers, in fact, because he's the father of nation Israel. In fact, his name will become Israel later, as we'll see. His name will be changed from Jacob to Israel. They're the same guy. And because of the sale of the birthright and the incident of Isaac's blessing, remember, that we've been studying back and look at chapter 27 and verse 36, we see that he has to leave home. 36 reads, "Then he said, is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times." And this is Esau talking. "He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." And it comes down to the fact that Isaac or Esau decides in verse 41, it says, "So Esau bore a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, 'The days of mourning for my father are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob.'" So he's set to kill Jacob, and Jacob has to, what we might say, get out of Dodge. He has to leave home. So he flees to Haran, and that's in verse 28. His departure is recorded in verse 1 through 9, and we looked at this last hour, just skimmed over it. First, its purpose is given in verse 1 and 2, where it says, "So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, 'You shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother.'" So the reason he is leaving is to find a wife, and of course to avoid being murdered by his brother. That probably had something to do with it. And then the promise in verse 3 through 5 said, "May God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. May he also give you the blessing of Abraham and to your descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham." Then Isaac sent Jacob away, and he went to Paddan Aram to Laban, the son of Bethuel, the wife of Aramean, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. So if you can follow all that, that's where he went. And that's the promise that Isaac gave to Jacob then. And then we looked at the parody of this in verse 6 through 9, where Esau saw that it didn't work out for him, and he had two Canaanite wives, and he figured, well, they just sent Jacob away to find a wife in Paddan Aram, and I have two Canaanite wives, and the reason they sent Jacob away is so he wouldn't marry a Canaanite. So what does Esau do to make things better? Well, he goes over to Ishmael and marries one of his family. Well, Ishmael is not of the promised line either. So even though Esau tries to do something right, he does it wrong. He was apparently trying to appease his parents, but the daughters of Ishmael aren't going to be of the seed any more than the Canaanite girls that he had already married. Now in verse 10 through 17 of chapter 28, we'll be looking at Jacob's dream, his vision. You could subtitle this Stairway to Heaven. And then in verse 18 through 22, his vow. And he makes a vow after seeing this vision. And I think it's where Jacob actually becomes a believer in this section. And we'll see, and I'll tell you why a little bit later. We'll look at another verse up in Hosea that seems to indicate that this is the point in Jacob's life where he became a believer. Now, before we start, I want to make a note on Hebrew grammar here as we start this section. It's quite common for Hebrew, when you're reading along, to find a summary followed by details. And we see this quite often. There will be a summary statement, and it'll be followed by the details of that summary statement. Similar to a newspaper headline. Think of it like a newspaper. You have a headline, and then down below you have the story that gives you the details of the headline. And this is what we're going to have in chapter 28 of Genesis. Chapter 28 starts out by saying, "So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him." And that's the headline of this section. And the details about the blessing follow. We had it back in, look back at Genesis 21. And this is a good thing to know when you're reading the Old Testament, that it's very common to find this phenomenon where you'll have a headline and then the details that follow. In fact, Genesis 1:1 is a headline. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then the details follow down. In Genesis chapter 21, verse 27 says, "Abraham took sheep and oxen and gave them to Abimelech, and the two of them made a covenant." That's the headline. Verse 28 through 34 give the details of that covenant that they made. So you see that we'll have a headline, and then we'll have details following. And it's always good to remember when we're reading in the Old Testament. You know, the Hebrews didn't write exactly the way we do, and we get in trouble with this sometimes because they had a little different idea on how things went. You know, Hebrew poetry is very beautiful, and we looked at an example of Hebrew poetry in the story of Jacob and Esau, in the story of Jacob stealing Esau's birthright, basically. The difference between Hebrew poetry and English poetry is that English poets generally try to rhyme sounds, while Hebrew poets rhyme ideas. So you'll see often in Hebrew, you'll see a statement and another statement that says the same thing in different words. That's rhyming ideas. That's Hebrew poetry. So I just wanted to make you aware of that as we go through this section. Now, the reasons. Why did they send Jacob to Haran? Well, first, if we read chapter 27, verse 42, the first thing is the anger of Esau. Verse 42 says, "Now when the words of her elder son Esau were reported to Rebekah, she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, 'Behold, your brother Esau is consoling himself concerning you by planning to kill you.'" Well, that's a great way to console yourself, isn't it? He was sad that he didn't get the blessing, so he was going to console himself by killing the person who did. That's not all too uncommon, I'm afraid, but that's what he did. So that's one reason why he was going to Haran. The second one was to find a suitable wife, because he was not to take a Canaanite girl for a wife. Remember, the girls that Esau married were literally driving Rebekah to her death. In verse 46 of chapter 27, I mentioned this last hour, Rebekah said to Isaac, "I'm tired of living because of the daughters of Heth." And those are the wives of Esau. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, like these from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? So Rebekah gets to the point where Esau's wives are getting to her so much, and Canaanite women were notorious for being Canaanite women. I mean, they didn't change. They didn't try to appease, apparently, Rebekah and Isaac. They kept their Canaanite practices, their Canaanite religion, their Canaanite idolatries, and it was driving Rebekah nuts. And she says, if Jacob does the same thing, then my life isn't even worth living. So she's in a bad position. This connects with chapter 28 and verse 2, where it says, arise, go to Paddan Aram, the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and from there take yourself a wife. Remember, that's where Abraham had sent his servant to find a suitable wife for Isaac, who was Rebekah. So Isaac and Rebekah say to Jacob, go to Rebekah's place where Isaac found a suitable wife and find yourself a suitable wife. So that's one of the reasons he had to leave. First, he had to get away from Esau, and then he had to find a suitable wife who wasn't a Canaanite girl with Canaanite values, because Canaanite girls were notorious for retaining their Canaanite values. So that introduces the promise of chapter 28. And there's two promises here. First, in verse 3, there's a promise concerning the land. Verse 3 says, may God Almighty bless you and make you fruitful and multiply you, that you may become a company of peoples. So concerning nation Israel, verse 3, he was going to be the father of nation Israel. Verse 4, he was going to possess the land. And verse 4 says, may he also give you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your descendants. It wouldn't be he that possessed the land, but his descendants with you, that you may possess the land of your sojournings, which God gave to Abraham. And of course, Jacob is one of those mentioned in the book of Hebrews that said they trusted God for things that they never saw in their entire life. It says they lived as strangers and aliens in the land that God promised them, and yet they still trusted God. Now, a note on verse 5, and this is just a kind of an interesting note on Hebrew grammar, where it says down at the end, the brother of Rebekah, the mother of Jacob and Esau. And that doesn't sound so strange to us, but to them it would, because it's customary in Hebrew, in Old Testament Hebrew, to list the oldest son first. But here it doesn't. It lists Jacob and Esau. Jacob was the younger. So normally, naming children, the firstborn is named. The order is purposely reversed here because Jacob is to be the one now whose seed will be passed along to become nation Israel, who will eventually produce the Messiah. So he has the blessing of Isaac, and he has the rights of the firstborn. He has the birthright that he purchased from Esau. He has the blessing of Isaac. So now he gets named first. And that's not by accident. That's on purpose. Those names are purposely reversed here. The Bible is incredibly accurate when you stop and think about it. You look about these little tiny things where you wouldn't really notice that normally, just reading along. But if you know a little Old Testament history, a little Hebrew history, and history of their customs, you note that normally the oldest is mentioned first. Here, it's reversed, and it's done purposely so that we know that Jacob now has all of the benefits of the elder son, because he now has the birthright, he now has the blessing. So let's look at Jacob's dream in verse 10 through 17. We left off at verse 9 last hour. Verse 10 through 17, let's read those verses. It says, "Then Jacob departed from Beersheba and went toward Haran. He came to a certain place and spent the night there, because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down in that place. He had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you live, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob woke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. He was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So there's Jacob's dream. His vision is given in verse 10 through 12. And up to this point, we find that Jacob really didn't have what we would call God consciousness. He wasn't what we would call a believer, I don't think. With this vision, we get the first bit of a personal relationship that Jacob has with God. You know, granted, before there was evidence that Jacob believed God, but it wasn't personal yet. He didn't have this personal relationship. Look at 28:16, where it says, then Jacob woke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it. So he was not God conscious at this point. He didn't even know it. He says, God is here. I didn't even know that. And this is the place where God will become personal to Jacob. And it's also the first of six times that God appears personally to Jacob. There will be six personal appearances, and this is the first one in verse 10 through 13. First, in verse 12, it's interesting that in the book of John, Jesus will apply this passage to himself. Look at verse 12, where it says, he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Now look at John chapter 1. John chapter 1 and verse 51. Jesus makes reference to this passage and he applies it to himself. It says in verse 51, and he said to him, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. So he's talking about that ladder that Jacob had seen in his vision. So Jesus is applying that vision to himself. What he's saying is that he is the only means whereby we can know the realities of heaven on earth. He's the only way that we can know the realities of heaven here on earth. And interesting note in the Greek, in John 1:51, when he says, you will see the heavens opened, that word opens is a perfect tense participle. What does that mean? Well, that means it's an action that was completed in the past and it has abiding results. So he opened the door once and for all. It's still open. That door is still open, and Jesus is represented by the ladder back in Jacob's vision. The next place we find Jacob having a personal visit from God is in Genesis chapter 31 and verse 11 to 13. 31:11 says, then the angel of God said to me in a dream, Jacob. And I said, here I am. He said, lift up your eyes and see that all the male goats which are mating are striped, speckled, and mottled. For I have seen all that Laban has been doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed a pillar, where you made a vow to me. Now arise, leave this land, return to the land of your birth. So verse 13 takes this context right back to Genesis 28 with the word Bethel. And we'll see that in verse 28. Bethel is what Jacob named the place where he had the vision. So that's what connects these two. It's a compound word. Beth means house of, and El is the short word for Elohim, God. So what does that mean? What does Bethel mean? House of God. We use that word in the title of our church. We use Beth Haven. That means house of rest. We use the Beth part of it anyway. That takes the context right back. Now look up at Hosea chapter 12. Hosea is right after the big book of Daniel, if you can't find it. Hosea chapter 12. In verse 3 and 4, we find that Bethel is in all probability where Jacob became a believer. Because Hosea 12:3 says, I'm talking about Jacob here, because it says, in the womb he took his brother by the heel, and in his maturity he contended with God. Now remember that, because we're going to look at that again in a moment. In his maturity he contended with God. But verse 4, yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. He found him at Bethel. So God found Jacob at Bethel. So that's why I say that's probably the place where Jacob became a believer, because that's where God found him. It says, and there he spoke with us. So Hosea 12:3 and 4 says he found him at Bethel. So we could subtitle this vision in Genesis 28:10 through 17, where Jacob met God. That's where God found Jacob. Now the next place we see the God and Jacob is in chapter 32, verses 1 and 2. Where it says, now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So another reference to Jacob and the angels of God. Then we have 32:24 through 28. Look down at verse 24, and it says, then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled him. Then he said, let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go until you bless me. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and men and have prevailed. So remember I said his name was going to be changed from Jacob to Israel? This is where it happens. And what did Hosea say about this incident? That's where he became mature. That's where he got his maturity. So that's the place of Jacob's maturity, according to Hosea 12:4. 35:9 is the next meeting with Jacob and God. Genesis 35:9, where it says, then God appeared to Jacob when he came from Paddan Aram, and he blessed him. So again, a personal appearance. And 46:1-4 is the last one. Genesis 46, verse 1 says, so Israel set out with all that he had. Remember, Israel is Jacob, same guy. Israel set out with all he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. God spoke to Israel in a vision of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And Jacob said, here I am. Again, another appearance of God to Jacob or Israel. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 28. We're looking at chapter 12 and 13 now in the vision that Jacob had. And in verse 12 it says, he had a dream, and behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. Now, the word behold, it's interesting, back in Genesis 28, the word behold occurs three times in this little section, and this is significant. It says, he had a dream, and behold, one, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven, and behold, twice, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it, and verse 13, and behold. So three times in these two verses, we have that word behold. And the word is designed to be very dramatic. It's a dramatic word. It's used for effect. It's very dramatic. We might write, instead of behold, gasp, or oh, or just mouth hanging open type thing. It's a very emphatic word, and it's used to be dramatic. And it's just repeated three times here. And another thing about this word is that when it's repeated, normally it goes from the general to the narrow. It becomes narrower each time it's repeated. So we have first the setting in verse 12. It talks about the ladder setting on earth. Behold, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reached to heaven. And then we have the participants, and behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending. And then down to the very detail, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said. See how it moves from the general to the detailed? And that's just one of the characteristics of that word. It's used for dramatic emphasis, and it goes from the general to the specific. Now in verse 12, the word ladder, it says, a ladder was set on the earth with its top reaching to heaven. Now, the first thing you need to do with that word ladder is get the English concept of a ladder out of your head, because it's not what we think of as a ladder. You would think of a ladder as what? A step ladder or an extension ladder. That's not the idea here at all. In fact, the best way to describe it would probably be stairway. It's a stairway. And I'm not sure why the translators decided to use the word ladder here, because the word describes a stairway. In fact, Henry Morris, in his commentary on the book of Genesis, calls this section Stairway to Heaven. Now, before you come up and ask me after class, I don't know if Led Zeppelin got the idea from this section. So don't bother to ask, okay? But that's what it means. It means a stairway. In fact, if you look back at 2 Samuel 20, or look up at 2 Samuel 20, we find a very similar word here. And it's translated differently up here. In 2 Samuel 20, verse 15, it says, they came and besieged him in Abel Beth Maach, and they cast up a siege ramp against the city. Now, siege ramp is that same word. If you have an older New American Standard, it might say mound, but it's, you know what a siege ramp is? It's a stairway, right, on wheels, and they roll it up to the wall of whatever they were trying to get into and walk up the stairs and give them access to where they wanted to get. So that's what that's the idea to have in your mind when you see this word back in Genesis 28. It's a stairway. It's a place where you can have access. That's the idea. Means of entering someplace. So in this vision, Jacob learned two things. He learned first, heaven was actual. He saw heaven. So he knew it was an actual place. And the second, he saw that heaven was accessible. They were going back and forth. You could go back and forth from heaven. And this, you know what, up in the New Testament, in the book of John, in 151, that's exactly what Nathanael was learning, is that you had access to heaven. Who was the ladder up there? Jesus Christ, remember? He said he was the ladder. So the access to heaven is available through Jesus Christ. And I might add, through Jesus Christ alone. You know, our Islam brothers don't have a siege ramp or a ladder stairway to heaven. They just don't have it. Only those who believe that Jesus Christ died on the cross for their sins can use this access ramp, if you want to call it that. Now, in verse 13 through 17, we have something interesting going on, and that is that God introduces himself to Jacob. And again, why do I say Jacob became a believer here? Because God introduced himself. Jacob didn't know him before. In verse 13, it says, and behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. So he introduces himself to Jacob. In verse 13, the last part, he says, the land on which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. That is the formal passing on of the Abrahamic covenant to Jacob. So Jacob was the one who was the seed. God told Rebekah, he said, Jacob will be the seed, the older will serve the younger. And now we have a formal declaration by God that Jacob, Israel, and his descendants will possess the land. How many times have we come across in the book of Genesis God promising Abraham or his descendants the land? We get up to New Testament times and we have preachers saying, the kingdom is only in your heart. It just doesn't make sense. God promises again and again and again and again, I will give you and your descendants this land. Not a warm, fuzzy feeling in your heart, but this land. And Jesus Christ will rule on the throne of his father David in this land. It can't be an allegory. It just doesn't make sense. It's mentioned again and again and again. God promises the land to nation Israel. And anybody who says it isn't their land is going to be in trouble. I don't know how many of you guys remember the Six-Day War, but the Arabs tried to take the land from Israel, and they learned a valuable lesson in 6 days. You don't take the land away from Israel. Now Israel's giving it away. But eventually, they will possess the land, and not just that little tiny strip that's called Israel today, but the entire land that God promised to Abraham. Physically possess that geographic location. Jacob makes a vow here now that he knows God, that he's a believer now in verse 18 through 22. And let's move on and read those verses in chapter 28, verse 18 through 22. It says, so Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. And he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take, and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. This stone, which I have set up as a pillar, will be God's house. And of all that you gave me, I will surely give a tenth to you. So there's Jacob's vow. First, we need to understand that in the ancient world, setting up a stone had significance. They served as markers. So in verse 18, where it says, Jacob rose early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up as a pillar and poured oil on its top. That was a significant thing because stones were used for markers. Notice how Jacob stands it up so it will be noticeable. It will get attention because it's out of its normal place. It's stood up. There's a stone, like Stonehenge. You know, I keep seeing on the History Channel, Stonehenge this, Stonehenge that. And my reaction is always, who cares, who cares? But that seems to be a big deal right now. But stones were used for markers. And they gain attention because they're standing upright, just like at Stonehenge. You know, up in Nebraska, we have Carhenge, which is even neater. And if you've never been there, you have to go to Carhenge and see the cars setting up. And they used these stones, they used them as grave markers, they used them to mark boundaries, and they used them to mark the location where a significant event occurred. And that's what Jacob's doing here. He's marking a place where there was a significant event. He set up that stone in devotion to the Lord. Now, we're going to find out in the Old Testament that later God is going to forbid this practice. He's going to say, don't set up stones as markers. And that's because the Canaanites did that in worship of their gods. And God said, I don't want you to worship like the Canaanites. But that's not in effect yet. So when Jacob sets up this stone, he does it from a pure heart. He's not breaking God's law yet. That comes later. Verse 19 is the commemoration where it says he called the name of that place Bethel. However, previously the name of the city had been Luz. So the previous name, and again, Bethel means house of God. And it's kind of interesting that he mentions the previous name, isn't it? It says it used to be Luz. And it may be significant. Now, you can't prove this for sure, but it may be an indication of this is the place where Jacob ceased to be separated from God. Because the name Bethel means house of God. The name Luz means separated. So it was Luz, separated. Now it's Bethel, house of God. It's a possibility. It's not, you know, you can't prove things like that, but it seems indicative that this is where Jacob met God. He was no longer separated from God. In verse 20 through 22, we have his dedication where it says, then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me. Now we have to stop here. What does he mean, if God will be with me? Then, down in verse 21, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. So you have an if clause there. If God does this, then I'll let him be my Lord. That's not the way it works, as you know. You know, we don't make demands on God. Say, oh, if you do this for me, then okay, I'll worship you. That's not how God operates. God says, you worship me this way. Now, most commentators agree that the meaning could be expressed better by the word since. And it says, Jacob made a vow saying, since God will be with me and will keep me on this journey that I take and will give me food to eat and garments to wear, and I return to my father's house in safety, then the Lord will be my God. He says, since God will do this, the Lord will be my God. So he's responding to something God has done for him. He's not putting conditions on God by saying, God, if you do this, I'll do that. We do that all the time. You know, the classic example of that, and I forget which movie this is in. You knew it was going to be a movie, didn't you? I think it was Burt Reynolds, and he was going to commit suicide, and he was swimming out to sea, and he was going to swim as far as he could so he couldn't get back. And when he gets out there, he changes his mind. So he tries to start swimming back, and he's making a deal with God, you know, and he says, oh, God, if you just get me back, I'm going to, you know, really change my life around. I'll give you 10% of my gross income. And then as he gets closer, he says, did I say gross? I meant net, you know, and kind of hedges back on the deal as he sees he's going to make it. But that's not how God operates. He doesn't make deals with us. He decides how we worship, and we worship the way he decides. And Jacob isn't saying, God, if you get me through this mess, I'll let you be my God out of the kindness of my heart. That's kind of how it reads, but that's nonsense. It's saying, God, since you did this for me, you're going to be my God. And that's what we do, isn't it? It says, God, since you sent your son and he died on the cross for my sins, you're my God. Because I believe that. So the dedication is based not on what God might do, but because of what God will do. You know, vows in the Old Testament were not made to get God to do something that he didn't want to do. We think of prayer like that or vows like that, that we try to get God to do something he doesn't want to do. God doesn't do that. He's immutable. That's not what vows were made to. They were made in the Old Testament to bind the worshiper to the vow, not God. They were made to bind the worshiper to his duty. Now, in verse 22, and we'll just end with this, notice Jacob's attitude has made a shift here. In verse 22, it says, "This stone, which I have set up as a pillar, will be God's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you." What have we seen of Jacob up until this time? Was he a giver? He was one of the biggest takers in the Old Testament, wasn't he? He took his brother's birthright for a bowl of soup. He made a deal that wasn't so ridiculous, it wasn't even a deal. And then he stole his brother's birthright, or his father's blessing, through sheer deception. Jacob was a taker. He took things. And now he's going to become a giver. You see what happens when God enters people's lives and they say, "Yeah, you're my God. I'm a believer now." Things change. We'll stop here. We might pick up with verse 29 next time, and I'm going to make a little foray into something I don't normally do called a topical Bible study, and it's going to be on the topic of prayer, and kind of like we're talking about here, we have some very great misconceptions about prayer, about its place in the life of the believer, and about its place in the life of the church. And I'm going to put a little topical study together about that so that we can all learn what exactly the place of prayer is in the life of the believer. But we'll see how far I can get this week on it. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the incredible privilege that we have to get together and study it. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.